Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
Can you imagine waking up every day, you cannot read, and you have to go out to the fields and work from the time you can see to the time you cannot see, and they did not give up hope that one day they knew they'd be free? And I say to you that I have not given up hope that one day we too shall be free.
On March 8, 1908, 15,000 textile workers took to the streets of New York demanding shorter working hours, better pay, voting rights, and an end to child labor practices. One year later, on February 28, the Socialist Party of America honored the strike by declaring a National Women's Day. The idea was expanded the following year to include the struggles of women worldwide, and on March 19, 1911, the first ever International Women's Day was celebrated across Europe. Since then, the United Nations marked March 8th as International Women's Day, when we commemorate women in the struggle for equal justice. This year, Bruderhof Radio marks the occasion with a look at women who are fighting not only for their own rights, but for the rights of all people, here in the United States. Today's program is a co-production with Blue Magazine, the magazine of political and spiritual activism and a sister media project of Bruderhof Radio. In a series of interviews with Blue editor Marianne Momsen, five women activists and artists spoke about their lives, their work, and their art. All of the comments heard on today's program can be read in full in the current issue of Blue Magazine, titled Women in Struggle. To begin with, we'll hear from Angela Davis, a longtime activist and critic of the prison industrial complex whose own arrest and wrongful conviction in 1970 won her national prominence. Here, Davis speaks of the 1960s in context of her work today.
The 60s was an era when there were global movements. Not only the civil rights movement in this country, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, but internationally, people were still rising up against colonialism. There were national liberation movements, figures such as Che Guevara, Patrice Lumumba. So that I would say that during that era, the perception was that we were on the cusp of a revolution, which may have inspired people in a way that is not possible today. I would say that in the 60s also, we had a much more simplistic idea of what it meant to conduct struggle, so that it was easier then as well. We tended to paint revolutionary ideals and movements and strategies in black and white terms, literally black and white, but also black and white in the sense that could single out an enemy and had not yet learned how to, formulate the complexities surrounding political issues, the relationship between state violence and domestic violence, for example, the intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality. We didn't have that conceptual apparatus. We didn't have that kind of a complex vision then. So I think that young people should not romanticize the 60s, but should simply recognize that this is a different era, that we know a lot more than we knew then, that we realize how much more complicated the process is that will lead us to a better world.
Angela Davis has provided inspiration to a unique group of women who make art an integral part of their activist work. In fact, one of the most prominent women hip-hop artists today, Medusa, is often referred to as the Angela Davis of hip-hop. Growing up in the shadow of the 1960s, Medusa's music was often influenced by the outspoken tradition of political activists like Angela Davis. It is these women, she says, that give her the courage to speak her mind today.
In the 60s, people were open with what they felt, politically or what have you, in regards to love, in regards to unity. And You know, I just feel like that was the perfect frame of mind for everyone to have. You know, like I always say, do it the way you feel it. You really have to speak your mind in order to be free. You know, I mean, that's true freedom, when you can actually not bite your tongue or hold back what you feel. You know what I mean? Just to appease someone else or another group of people. You know what I mean? So I think that mentality followed me from my childhood into this. You know, because there's a lot of people that are being dictated to, you know, what they should be saying or what they should be singing about. And then those that are free with their speech, truly free, they don't get as much recognition.
In the 1960s, speaking one's mind was less a question of recognition than of life and death. On the cover of Blue Magazine's women's issue is the last known photograph of Malcolm X, taken just moments before his death in 1965. With his head thrown back and his chest full of bullet holes, the great leader seems about to utter his final words. Above him, calm yet intense, is a Japanese woman. Her name is Yuri Kochiyama. In 1965, Kochiyama was living in Harlem with her husband when she met Malcolm X for the first time. Radicalized by the experience of anti-Japanese racism during World War II, both had already been active in the civil rights struggles of the time. Still, it was not until she met Malcolm X face to face that Kochiyama felt truly free to exercise her role as an activist.
Listening to him talk, I mean, he was always teaching. He was teaching more than black history. He was teaching what was happening internationally. He was different from every other black or Negro leader. He didn't believe in becoming a part of this government that harms so many other people. He believed in independence, an independent black nation. But I think Malcolm, even though he was demonized and all that by the press, he had the heart of the black people, especially the poor people and those in the ghettos, and I think any marginalized people, because he was telling the truth that most leaders were afraid to say of all the negativities in this country, like racism and inequalities. And because in Africa, African nations were trying to free themselves from the colonization of Europeans, that as people heard what Malcolm was saying, they felt Malcolm was more on target. And when you think today, as there is progress all over the world in the resistance movement and those who are against anti-imperialism, we feel Malcolm was certainly one of the greatest leaders of all time. He was speaking out on the most crucial issues.
Sonia Sanchez is another woman whose life was heavily influenced by Malcolm X. Like Yuri Kochiyama, Sanchez was exposed to the pain of racism early in life. Coming from the Deep South, she gravitated to Harlem in early 1960 and first met Malcolm X there less than a year later. Something in the way he spoke, Sanchez says, made her feel that she was being swept along in the currents of history.
But I learned from Malcolm, this Malcolm who did these what I call short poetic statements. In fact, I did on WBAI, after his death, I took his speeches and did poems from him. You know, I showed people the reason why he appealed to many of us, because it was poetry. And I divided the line, you know, and broke the line up and spoke it in a cadence. And people could hear it, you know. The cadence of his voice, the rhythm of his voice, okay? How he punctuated words, how he stressed words, you know, how he used humor, how he would use, you know, black English along the way. You see what I'm saying? And so what we did is that, and he was very raw on some things, right?
Right.
You know, and always on time. So what we did is we did the same thing. We responded to this Malcolm, right? Because Jimmy Baldwin said, and it's so in New York Times in about 79, I think, Baldwin said, the brutal truth is that America never had any interest in educating black people, except as this could serve white purposes. It is not the black child's language that is in question. It is not his language that is despised. It is his experience.
Mm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
I love Baldwin. If you want to learn how to write essays, read Baldwin, you know?
Mm.
And that's what we're saying. What we decided to do, because what Malcolm was doing is that he was bringing our experience in a political way
right.
to us. And we went, whoops, our heads got jerked around. You know, it got knocked back. We sat back and we couldn't, you could barely breathe sometimes. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He would just sock it to us. So in our poetry, that's why I identify so with the rappers. Because in our poetry, we got up on stage and went, da 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 da. Boom, boom, take that sucker, boom, boom, boom. You don't like that?
Right.
Boom, how about this? Boom, boom, boom. Ha, 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 boom, 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 boom. And people like, what? Whoa, hold it. People initially walked out on some of us, you know, said, I didn't come to hear this kind of stuff because, you know, it was frightening. You see, people were nervous. I didn't want, and then we got up on stages and called ourselves black poet. I said I was a black woman poet, which is interesting going back looking at some of my notes from that time, right? You know, people didn't want to be, I'm a Negro with a capital N. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And maybe some people said Afro-American. A few political people said Afro-American.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you know, we were black.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, black was not necessarily a nice word at that particular time. And I'm even talking about going on through the 60s, that a lot of people, you know, will claim Malcolm now. Through stamps, through his image. But then I asked